Chapter 6. Polokwane, the Scorpions, and Glenister 1. Be the change you want to see in the world, so said Mahatma Gandhi. I first met Bob Glenister in February 2008 at the breakfast buffet at the Protea Hotel in Illovo, Johannesburg, which shares a parking area with the Wanderers Club. Given our respective schedules, a breakfast meeting was all we could manage. Bob, a business person, was based in Johannesburg. I was based in Cape Town and visited Johannesburg infrequently. At that time, I was still director of the Centre for Constitutional Rights, and our panel of experts was due to meet in the club later that morning. That is why I was in Johannesburg and briefly available to meet Bob. Bob's attorney, Kevin Louis of the firm Wertheim Becker, had phoned me and asked me to meet Bob about the ANC's resolution, passed at its national conference at Polokwane a few weeks previously, to dissolve the Directorate of Special Operations, or Scorpions, the anti-corruption unit based in the National Prosecuting Authority, and replace it with a unit based in the police. Bob, like many right-thinking South Africans, was horrified. He was also concerned about the leadership change at Polokwane, where the Zuma tsunami had ousted the Mbeki team. As a businessman with a considerable investment in South Africa, he feared the worst if the state machinery for combating corruption were to be watered down, and was so appalled by this prospect that he was prepared to do something about it. But what? That was the issue we met to discuss. In The Dream Deferred, the Mbeki biography released in November 2007, just before Polokwane, Mark Gefisser had written, "I knew from his confidants that Mbeki was deeply distressed by the possibility of being succeeded by Zuma, and that he believed his deputy's play for the presidency to be part of a strategy to avoid prosecution. Mbeki allegedly worried that Zuma and his backers had no respect for the rule of law and would be unaccountable to the constitutional dispensation the ANC had put in place if they came to power. For Mbeki and those around him, a Zuma presidency was a scenario far worse than a dream deferred. It would be, in effect, a dream shattered irrevocably as South Africa turned into yet another post-colonial kleptocracy. By the time I met Bob for breakfast, a Zuma presidency was a racing certainty. This was because of the relationship between the national and ANC presidencies and how this got out of sync at Polokwane, or more accurately, how Mbeki sought to disrupt this relationship and it got back in sync, albeit brutally, at Polokwane. The South African president is elected by parliament at its first sitting after a general election. While in theory any member of parliament could be elected, this effectively means the ANC elects its president. The ANC president, in turn, is elected by the ANC's national conference, which is also held every 5 years. So is the party's deputy president, who, in terms of the template established by Mandela's succession, is meant to succeed the party president and eventually ascend to the national presidency. Mbeki and Zuma were elected as ANC president and deputy president in 1997 and re-elected in 2002. They were also elected as national president and deputy president in 1999 and re-elected in 2004. Due to the two-term limitation in the national constitution, Mbeki's national presidency would expire in 2009. However, there was no term limit on the ANC presidency. At Polokwane, the ANC resolved to introduce this as well. In ordinary circumstances, Zuma would or should have peacefully succeeded Mbeki at Polokwane and ascended to the national presidency 2 years later. However, following Mbeki's dismissal of Zuma as deputy president in June 2005, following the latter's implication in the Sheikh corruption trial, Mbeki decided to contest the ANC presidency for an unusual third term. Had Mbeki won the leadership contest, he would presumably have determined the party's candidate for the national presidency in 2 years' time and remained the power behind the national throne. However, a month before our meeting at the Protea Hotel, the Zuma tsunami, a term coined by COSATU General Secretary Azwelin Zimavavi, then one of Zuma's co-conspirators who later bitterly regretted his decision, had swept Mbeki out of the ANC presidency and his followers out of key positions in the party and subsequently in government. Like many business people, Bob was worried about the future under the new regime so feared by Mbeki, and was keenly aware that the constitution was the last line of defense. An unrestrained elite would soon steal South Africa blind, bringing all hopes of a happy and prosperous rainbow nation future crashing down with it. Bob views all politicians with a healthy degree of skepticism, but detests crooked ones especially. When he arrived at breakfast wearing his trademark black leather jacket, he was accompanied by his attorney, Kevin Louis, and Alf Cockrell, his junior counsel. The leader of his team, David Unterhalter SC, was out of the country. The subject for discussion was what to do about the impending dissolution of the Scorpions. Ironically, the Scorpions were a creature of the ANC. The decision to urgently establish a special and adequately staffed and equipped investigative unit to deal with all national priority crimes, including police corruption, was announced in June 1999 by none other than Thabo Mbeki, newly minted as national president, only a week or so before. The nature of the decision and the perceived urgency surrounding it suggested, and still does, that Mbeki was privy to information which indicated that the country needed the Scorpions sooner rather than later. Following this policy decision, the Scorpions were devised and established by Bulelani Nguka, National Director of Public Prosecutions, and the Minister of Justice, Penwell Maduna, who had become one of the panel of experts at the Centre for Constitutional Rights. Staffed by more than 500 people, the Scorpions began operating in September 1999. The Scorpions worked in terms of a Troika principle, under which investigators, prosecutors, and forensic experts collaborated on dealing with organized crime and corruption. Global experience has taught that criminal prosecutions are vital. There is no doubt that a culture of impunity takes root rapidly when corruption is not investigated and convictions are not secured. The Scorpions set out to combat corruption in a coordinated and therefore more efficient way. The literature on susceptibility to corruption is similarly instructive. It shows that 10% of the global population is corrupt, no matter what. 10% is incorruptible, no matter what. And 80% can go either way, depending on the circumstances. This means that, given the effect of anti-corruption measures, most of the 80% can be deterred from engaging in corrupt activities. If, however, such measures are lacking, the 80% are more likely to succumb to temptation, mainly because they believe they can get away with it. In an African context, in particular, this gives rise to a culture of impunity and the development of post-colonial kleptocracies. the morphing of popular liberation struggles into politicians' struggle for untrammeled power is the history of much of post-colonial Africa. By adopting a supreme constitution, including a Bill of Rights, South Africans set out to do better than many of the countries to our north. Significantly, however, the Zuma tsunami also involved another resolution taken in the interests of the constitutional imperative for a single police service, that the Scorpions be dissolved, that the members performing policing functions should fall under the police. Mirroring Mbeki's concerns, by going the other way, the resolution added that the relevant legislative changes should be effected as a matter of urgency. Was the decision to disband the Scorpions the proverbial canary in the coal mine, a warning that the country was veering away from the rule of law and toward the failed state status of so many of its neighbours to the north? These were the issues weighing on our minds as the summer sun shone on us in the hotel eatery. Bob had a bold strategy in mind. He wanted to use public interest litigation to nip the deviation from the proper administration of criminal justice he saw in the decision to disband the Scorpions in the bud. The problem with this strategy was that given the doctrine of separation of powers entrenched in the Constitution, the courts usually defer to the other spheres of government when governance problems arise. They like to be approached as a last resort, not the first. The Polokwane resolution in respect of the Scorpions amounted to an instruction to the ANC's parliamentary caucus and ultimately the national executive to abolish the Scorpions and replace them with a unit in the SAPS. Parliament was still in recess and the executive had done nothing yet to start the process of dissolving the Scorpions and creating the Hawks. It was conceivable that the executive would not act on the resolutions or that Parliament would balk at passing the necessary legislation. The problem facing deferential judges sitting in the matter Bob had in mind is that they would not know how the processes of lawmaking would unfold and whether the Scorpions would in fact be dissolved and what would be put in place to replace them. The cabinet would need to decide to act on the resolution and instruct the government law advisers to draft the necessary legislation. The bill would then need to be tabled in the two houses of parliament, referred to the relevant standing committees, returned to the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces in amended form, voted on, and sent to the president, who, if satisfied with its consistency with the Constitution, would sign it into law. In order to persuade a court to intervene, it was necessary for Bob to plead exceptional circumstances, in that once the legislative process had been completed, it would be too late for the courts to intervene in the normal way, and that urgent intervention in the form of an interdict and declaratory relief was indicated. Determining what exceptional circumstances actually means is like asking about the length of a piece of string. As for being without a remedy, much the same applies. It depends. Bob was aware that top Scorpion staff were leaving in droves, unimpressed with the prospect of a future in the South African police service, and willing to sacrifice their state pensions for prospects in the private sector. The state had spent a lot of money on training the Scorpions' investigators. Some had attended courses at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, in the United States, and others at Scotland Yard in the United Kingdom. If the Scorpions were dissolved, its accumulated expertise would be dissipated and its institutional memory destroyed, thus fatally undermining the national project of fighting corruption. Almost certainly, the Hawks would not investigate the top politicians in whom the Scorpions were taking an interest. This has proven to be the case since. The former National Police Commissioner, Jackie Salebi, and the Northern Cape politician, John Block, are the only big fish convicted of corruption since the Scorpions were disbanded. However, both investigations were initiated by the Scorpions. In the Protea Hotel, the coffee grew cold as the discussion heated up in the crucible of arguments on the issues. The lawyers, as they usually do, looked at the downside of taking on the state. Bob asked me how I rated his chances of success. I replied that unless he took action, he would never know, but that if he did nothing, the Scorpions would almost certainly be disbanded and their accumulated expertise dissipated, thus allowing the worst of the rapidly developing feral elite to save their skins. "Will your centre back us if we take them on?" asked Bob. I replied that it probably would. I explained the non-confrontational and cooperative ethos of the Centre for Constitutional Rights to Bob and promised him that I would, at the meeting I was about to attend, propose that we participate as a friend of the court. The issues in the case would impact upon the extent of the constitutionally guaranteed independence of the National Prosecuting Authority, the efficiency and effectiveness of corruption busting, and the enjoyment of guaranteed human rights by all. Separation of powers among the judiciary and other arms of government would play a decisive role. Our treaty obligations related to combating corruption would be implicated, and the lot of those who depended on the state social security net would be affected. Money lost to corruption does not find its way to the poor. It is spent on fast cars, slow horses, and loose living. In the first 20 years of democratic South Africa, some 700 billion had been swallowed up by corruption. This is more than twice the amount needed to eliminate the housing backlog of some 2.1 million housing units, and enough to train the competent teachers so badly needed from early childhood development to matric level, equip them to teach in their learners' home languages, and work in properly equipped schools and classrooms. The issues in the case Bob was contemplating, as we asked for more coffee, were huge. It would also almost certainly cost him a lot of money. He fiddled with the sugar sachets, but showed no other signs of nerves about making a call that would change his life and those of many others. "Okay, let's do it," he said. "Where do we start?" A discussion ensued on what he would need to place before the court. Evidence of the motives behind the resolution, information about the rate of attrition among Scorpion staff, and contextual information about the growth of corruption were all needed. Assembling the necessary affidavits would be a massive task. Cockerell and Louis looked at each other with a mixture of alarm and anticipation. The cabinet would probably move more rapidly to implement the urgent ANC resolution than the papers for the case could be prepared. Therefore, it seemed safe to prepare them on the basis that the cabinet decision would be the point of attack. Section 2 of the Constitution makes it clear that any law or conduct inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid. Therefore, any cabinet decision to forge ahead with dissolving the Scorpions via a legislative process could be characterized as conduct inconsistent with the Constitution. I went off to the panel of experts, the meeting in the Wanderers Clubhouse, leaving the others to sort out the logistics of the huge task Bob had given his lawyers. I was pleased to find that the members of the panel were also very concerned about the ANC resolution and supported the idea that the centre should intervene as an amicus or friend of the court, should the opportunity present itself. An amicus is prepared to join in proceedings if it has something to add to the arguments already ventilated by the antagonists. It also seemed likely that opposition political parties would want to make capital out of the case and would also seek to intervene as amici. A few weeks later, Bob found himself in the coffee shop below Kevin Louie's office in Hyde Park, Johannesburg. He was asked to wait there as the final touches were being put on the founding affidavit. By then, the cabinet had indeed decided to initiate the legislation needed to disband the Scorpions, and the case was built around assailing the decision as unconstitutional. Bob was now more aware of the huge and intimidating extent of the challenge. He hesitated and pondered. He felt the need for a sign, so he selected a sugar sachet at random from the bowl on the coffee shop counter and read the inspirational quote on the back. The quote on his sachet read, "Be the change you want to see in the world, Mahatma Gandhi." This was all Bob needed. He swore to the founding affidavit without further hesitation. He was taking on the full might of the state in an urgent application to the North Gauteng High Court in Pretoria to stop the dissolution of the Scorpions with immediate effect. He was paying his legal team top dollar to argue the case in the knowledge that if he did not proceed, the Scorpions would almost certainly be destroyed and with significant consequences for the country's future. The first step was an urgent application brought in March in the North Gauteng High Court for an interdict restraining the government from initiating legislation that would disestablish the Scorpions. The application was brought by Bob with the African Christian Democratic Party, Democratic Alliance, Independent Democrats, United Democratic Front, and Inkatha Freedom Party as friends of the court. Predictably, the state's legal representatives argued every technical point available to them. After reserving judgment, Justice Willem van der Merwe delivered his judgment at the end of May. A strong argument, he said, had been made on the applicant's behalf that this was an exceptional case in which the separation of powers should be ignored and a court should interfere with the right of the executive to initiate legislation. A high court should only interfere in this way in exceptional circumstances, and the facts in this case did not make it an exceptional one. Besides this, the matter involved crucial political matters. Given these two factors, the High Court had no jurisdiction to decide the application. However, he said, it could fall within the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court. In line with his finding, the application was struck off the roll. Bob was spared the costs of paying for opposing counsel. All the parties agreed that because the matter was constitutionally significant, no order as to costs should be made. This effectively meant that Bob would pay his own legal team and the state respondents would pay theirs. Bob's team immediately drafted an application for leave to appeal to the Constitutional Court, alternatively seeking direct access to that court. Following this ruling, Parliament continued to process the bills drafted to give effect to the Polokwane resolution and the subsequent cabinet decision to implement the resolution. This process involved the appointment of a joint ad hoc committee drawn from the Police and Justice Portfolio Committees in the National Assembly. This procedure was necessary as amending the law in respect of the National Prosecuting Authority involved the Justice Portfolio Committee, while establishing a new unit in the police to be called the Directorate of Priority Crime Investigation, or HAWCS, involved the Portfolio Committee on Police. Bob organized a petition, which was eventually signed by more than 100,000 people. He went to Parliament and made representations to the Joint Committee. So did the Centre for Constitutional Rights, the Helen Suzman Foundation, the Institute for Democracy in South Africa, or IDASA, and even a concerned members group from within the National Prosecuting Authority. All these interventions were to no avail. ANC members of Parliament were only interested in how best to implement the Polokwane resolution, and not in whether it was constitutional, rational, or desirable. Maggie Sotiu, co-chair of the Joint Parliamentary Committee in particular, was not interested in hearing submissions regarding the advisability of the scheme to shut down the Scorpions and only wanted to hear how this could best be done. The constitutionality of depriving the country of its independent and effective anti-corruption machinery of state and the impact of this on its place in the world, as well as its international obligations, were of no concern to her. An instruction from the party bosses in Luthuli House was on the table, and it was her job to put it into effect. This kind of conduct, widely referred to as the rubber stamping of executive decisions, has the effect of weakening Parliament as an oversight and accountability body to which the Cabinet and the public administration are answerable. And this has certainly happened in South Africa. Our weak Parliament is a direct result of the proportional representation system utilized for national and provincial elections, in terms of which citizens do not vote for candidates in their own constituencies, but for a political party, which chooses its own candidates. This does not happen at local government level, where people vote for ward councillors as well as parties. This national and provincial voting system has been in place since 1994, initially provided for in the interim constitution. It was meant to be a stopgap measure that would allow the 1994 elections to proceed in the simplest possible way. The final constitution carried over the system with minor modifications to the 1999 elections. In 2002, the government appointed a 13-member electoral task team chaired by Frederick van Sail Slabbert, former leader of the opposition in the apartheid era and co-founder of IDASA, to draft legislation for the 2004 and subsequent elections. The majority of the commissioners proposed a mixed proportional representation and constituency system similar to that in Germany. However, the government accepted the view of a minority, said to have towed the ANC line, that proportional representation should continue. Commenting on the outcome, Slabbert declared it was obvious from the outset that the government did not really have a serious appetite for changing the system. This is hardly surprising, as the current system reduces the accountability of members of parliament to voters in specific constituencies and makes it easier to force members of parliament to toe the party line. Besides being nominated by their parties and the likelihood of their getting into Parliament depending on their positions on the party lists, members of Parliament also lose their seats when they cease to be a member of the party on whose list they were elected, unless the floor-crossing schedule to the Constitution is invoked. The prospect of losing their parliamentary seats, salaries and fringe benefits works wonderfully to concentrate the minds of parliamentarians, notably including their finding all sorts of reasons for doing exactly what the party bosses tell them to do. And so it was with the draft legislation to dissolve the Scorpions and transferring its functions to the police. The public participation process in Parliament was farcical, and the outcome of foregone conclusion. Outside Parliament, the Secretary General of the ANC, Gwedi Mantashe, openly acknowledged that the motivation for dissolving the Scorpions was that the ANC members under investigation by the Scorpions needed to be protected against this intrusion. This perspective was illuminated by the parliamentary Travelgate scandal, which broke in early 2005. Initially investigated to little effect by the police, but then handed over to the Scorpions, it turned into a major embarrassment for the ANC when scores of its members were compelled to plead guilty to defrauding Parliament by abusing their parliamentary travel privileges to the tune of 18 million rand. MPs entered into plea bargains that saved them their jobs on condition that they would pay back the money. The Constitutional Court heard Bob's application on the 20th of August 2008. In advance of the hearing, it issued a direction that it wanted to hear argument on only one point, which it framed in a way that did not bode well for Bob's initiative. Whether, in the light of the doctrine of the separation of powers, it is appropriate for this court, in all the circumstances, to make any order setting aside the decision of the National Executive that is challenged in this case. The sole question for decision is, therefore, whether it is appropriate for this court to intervene at this stage of the legislative process. The Centre for Constitutional Rights nevertheless decided to participate as an amicus curiae and launched an application to do so with the kind assistance of the pro bono department of the legal firm Bowman Gilfillan. As it seemed likely that the case would be lost, but the legislation to follow could still be impugned, we decided to lay the groundwork for the litigation to come by attacking the structural and operational flaws in the new and pending legislation. The UDM also briefed counsel Michael Osborne of the Cape Bar to argue the matter as an amicus. Accordingly, there was a host of counsel at court on the morning of the 20th of August 2008. Chief Justice Pius Langer met us in the anteroom beside the court in his usual friendly and understated way. When I asked after his health, he quietly replied, "I am well, in spite of the content of the letters you write me." A wry reference to correspondence about disciplinary proceedings against the Western Cape Judge President John Schlorpy. The latter had, in May 2008, been accused by all of the judges of the Constitutional Court of interfering with their deliberations on a judgment affecting the rights of Jacob Zuma. The batting order and time allocations were quickly sorted out. Bob's team would go first, followed by the two amici, State would respond after lunch, and Bob's team would get a chance to reply. It was clear from the outset that the court felt that there were no exceptional circumstances that would justify intervening in the legislative process at this early stage. David Unterhalter is a skilled and persuasive advocate, but nothing he pulled out of the hat seemed to have an impact. The Centre for Constitutional Rights was up next. I rose with trepidation. Again, nothing I said seemed to make the slightest difference. The justices were not interested in deviating from their default position of deference to the executive and legislative arms of government. My submission that the court should not sit on its hands and do nothing while an institution as valuable as the Scorpions was being destroyed by a resolution passed for the basest of reasons, only seemed to irritate the judges further. Michael Osborne rose next with similar results. While he was arguing, Alf Cockrell leant over to me and said, sotto voce, the fate of the Scorpions was sealed. Therefore came as a surprise when after lunch, Justices Zach Yacoub and Cato Regan sharply criticised the way in which counsel for the State had argued his case. Justice Yacoub was particularly severe in respect of the mendaciously worded affidavit by The then Director General of the Department of Justice, Menzi Simelane. Simelane later became the first National Director of Public Prosecutions in the Zuma administration, only to be unceremoniously deposed by the courts. Justice Yacoub felt that the deponent was trifling with the court and voiced his displeasure in no uncertain terms. Eventually, counsel wisely abandoned the contents of Simelane's affidavit and argued the case on points of law. The separation of powers and the deference the courts owe to the other two main branches of government, the executive and the legislature, formed the basis of the argument presented. With a good deal of prescience, Justice O'Regan taxed counsel with questions about the effect of the scheme to disband the Scorpions on South Africa's international obligations under the United Nations Convention Against Corruption to maintain an effective and independent anti-corruption entity. They assured her that this aspect would be taken into account in drafting the new laws. Nothing that David Unterhalter argued in reply seemed to make an impact. Cases are seldom won on the strength of argument in reply, and it seemed as if Bob's case would not be an exception. We did not have long to wait for a judgment. The court found, unanimously, that the case was premature. If Bob did not like the end product of the legislative process, which was still underway, he was free to return to court after the new laws had been enacted. The decision was written by the Chief Justice Lange himself, acknowledging the wide public interest in the matter. He wrote it in a way that would make the judgment accessible to lay readers as well as lawyers. After reviewing the factual background, Chief Justice Lange stated that the court was dealing with the constitutionally mandated power of the executive to initiate legislation and the power of the legislature to enact it. Reasons for justifying intervention by the Constitutional Court in this instance should at least demonstrate material and irreversible harm that could not be remedied once the legislation had been enacted. The applicant had argued that judicial intervention was appropriate because of the negative effect the draft legislation would have on the daily operations of the Scorpions. In particular, the applicant's counsel had pointed to information that many Scorpions employees had resigned and argued that this was occurring because of the plan to disestablish the Scorpions. The move would have a material and irreversible effect on the Scorpions, undermine the state's capacity to render basic security, and harm the constitutional order. There would be no remedy in the future because it would be too late. First, Chief Justice Lange noted, this argument was premised on the assumption that the legislation would be enacted without material change. However, Parliament might choose to amend the legislation or not enact it at all. Second, it was not clear that the members of the Scorpions were leaving because of the decision to disestablish the Scorpions. Even if they were, this would not necessarily constitute irreversible harm sufficient to warrant intervention. Institutions often experience times of change and uncertainty, as well as high levels of staff turnover, which in this instance were not extreme enough to warrant intervention. The applicant had also argued that the President and the Cabinet were seeking to disestablish the Scorpions because a number of ANC members had received its unwelcome attentions. Again, if this argument had any foundation, appropriate relief could be sought in due course. The UDM had argued that the executive was following the dictates of the governing party rather than its responsibilities in terms of the Constitution. In his view, Chief Justice Lange noted, there was nothing wrong with the Cabinet seeking to give effect to the policy of the governing party. In so doing, however, the Cabinet had to observe its constitutional obligations. If the eventual legislation breached the Constitution, it could be declared invalid. The UDM had also argued that, having regard to what it refers to as the relative marginalization of the legislature and the dangers of one-party domination, the court should act because no one else would. Chief Justice Lange could not agree. The role of this court, he wrote, is established in the Constitution. It may not assume powers that are not conferred upon it. Moreover, the considerations raised by the UDM do not establish that irreversible and material harm will eventuate should the court not intervene at this stage. Lastly, the Centre for Constitutional Rights had argued that the draft legislation posed a significant threat to the independence of the National Prosecuting Authority and would harm the structure of the Constitution. This argument assumed that the draft legislation would remain unchanged during its passage through Parliament. The court could not make this assumption and had to proceed on the basis that Parliament would observe its constitutional duties. If the draft legislation did threaten structural harm to the Constitution or the National Prosecuting Authority, Parliament would have a duty to prevent such harm, and it would be inappropriate for the court to intervene in the process of lawmaking on the assumption that Parliament would not observe its constitutional obligations. Again, should the legislation turn out to be unconstitutional, appropriate relief could be obtained thereafter. Given this, the applicant had not established that it was appropriate for the court to intervene in the affairs of Parliament in this case, and had not shown that material and irreversible harm would result if the court did not intervene. In the circumstances, both the application for leave to appeal and the application for direct access to the Constitutional Court were refused. While the judgment had run against us, it opened the door for a determined litigant to take the matter further once the legislation had found its way onto the statute book. Though it was a victory for the government, it was a victory on the narrowest possible basis, with the court declining to make any unnecessary findings in refusing the relief claimed by Bob. All of the arguments concerning the validity, legality, and constitutionality of the scheme to disband the Scorpions and replace them with the Hawks were still very much alive. While the government had won the first battle, the war would continue.